Okay. Welcome, everybody. So what I wanted to go over today, I put out here are two paragraphs from the story of Abraham. And the idea is when you go on to registry.com, you want to understand your roots, right? So you try to figure out your family tree, right? So for us, well, everybody sitting here, we are part of a big family, the Jewish people, and it goes back to Abraham. It all starts with him. And I was studying with Michael Baer on Friday. It was like this idea comes up a lot that whatever kind of preconceived notions or whatever understandings we've created or developed when we were younger of God, of all the different ideas that are associated with it, with our Judaism, as we get older, we have an obligation as we mature that our ideas and our thoughts and understanding of things has to mature as well. We're advanced in different, you know, whatever, let's say you're a lawyer, right? So you went to school, you have years of experience as an attorney. So how many years have we worked on developing and becoming more sophisticated in our understanding of God and our Judaism? We have to do, you know, whatever, however we specialize in X, Y, and Z, we need to mature and develop our ideas of God, of how we understand God and how we understand Judaism. And to start out, we need to start at point A, which is Abraham, and look at a couple of passages about Abraham and see his discussions with God, which there aren't that many, as we think that there's so many discussions. They really are very limited, but they're very powerful. And actually, anybody see the movie Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield? No. Anybody? Okay, so there's a scene in that movie. So but the story is his son doesn't really want to go to college. He's like this very successful businessman. So the only way his son will go is if he goes. So he says, fine, I'll go. He never got a college degree. He goes with his son. So there's a scene of he hires different people to do the different work for him because he's not doing his work. So he hires the author of a book to write the paper for him on the book, right? So I think it was Faulkner. He's like, hires Faulkner to write. And then he gets back the paper, and he gets an F. And he calls the teacher, like, I don't understand. So this is not what Faulkner meant, right? Okay, right? So, like, that's like...
I love it. Right? I was just like that in school.
Okay.
I remember them well.
So, but when we look at the Torah, so the Torah is God's book. God wrote the Torah. Now, what I mean by that is also, we have to be very precise in what that means. So God didn't write the Torah in the sense that he didn't sit and take out a pen and write these lines. He transmitted it to Moses, and it's actually in this week's parsha. We just read Baaloscha at the end of the parsha. Miriam says what's called Lashon Hara. She says something about her brother, and through that episode, we get a sense of who Moses was. Moses was the greatest prophet of all time. One of our tenets of a belief, the 13 principles of belief that Maimonides put forward, was one of the things is that we must believe in Moses' ability to, his prophecy is like the basis of everything. And so, now ready? Here's where we become adults, okay? An adult understanding, we have to get our heads around this, is that God doesn't speak. Why doesn't God speak? Do you know why God doesn't actually speak? Why? Because God's not physical. So that's another tenet of our belief. We believe that God is not a physical being. As a physical being, we speak. Right? We articulate. It's a physical thing that's happening. But if God's not physical, he doesn't speak the way we understand speech. Okay? God communicates, though. He communicates in a way that's not physical. So now, you need a prophet of Moses' caliber to be able to connect and understand and be able to receive those communications. Okay, so this is already an adult understanding, much more sophisticated, of, you know, what's going on when we talk about the Torah. But it's God's book, right? So now also, did God give us the Torah, the five books of Moses at Mount Sinai? The answer is no. He gave us the Ten Commandments. Or he actually he himself directly only gave us the first of the Ten Commandments, the two first of the Ten Commandments. And then the Jewish people were like, we cannot handle this. It's just too much. And then after that, Moses was in between. So, but the idea, though, is that God gives over, he communicates, and Moses is, we need Moses' tremendous ability to be able to take in the communication and then transpose it and put it into words for us. Okay, so this, the book, the five books of Moses is God's word, that Moses is the filter that brings it to us. Okay, that's an adult, this is an adult idea, but it's very important that we understand it. Why? Because our understanding of what God is and who God, and how we need to, like, oh, again, we might be working with a 5 to 10 year old understanding of God. Now here, again, back to this week's parasha. Moses has, Rashi explains, that Moses had this ability to see God. It's called an espaklaria hami'ira. Now what that means is, take the window over there, okay? Espaklaria means, translated, is a barrier. There's some kind of filter, okay? The glass is the filter. When we look at glass, we look through a window. If we're too close, or if it, depending on the light, what do we see? We see a reflection of ourselves, right? So, but if it's clear, if it's really clean, I see straight through, and I'm able to see clearly, okay? So now, Isbaklaria Mira, what it meant with Moses' ability to see God, he saw through the window with that almost no reflection of himself. He saw God clearly without any of himself. We, on the other hand, we create images of God that are projections. A lot of it is us, right? We see God, but there's a lot of us, so we create images that are really our own self-created images of God. Now, here's where we take it up a notch. Again, this is stuff that needs to be, you have to like think about. It's not like simple ideas, but again, as adults, we need to kind of take the next step, and that is, when we look and try to understand God, God is the Ein Sof. He's the unlimited. Now, what does that mean? We are a limited being. So how do we understand an unlimited being when we have these limitations? So it's something that we have to work on. But the reason we work on it is because when we understand, we use the word almighty, right? Like the unlimited, almighty. God is the almighty. When we try to get that sense of understanding, so then, you know, it's again, it's something that we work on, develop, and then when we connect to it, we have it could be extremely comforting and very exciting, but it's something that's we work through and develop an understanding, a greater understanding of our own understanding of God. Okay, now why do I, you know, we're bringing this full circle is that when we look at these verses in the Torah, we're getting it from the endless God. So if I'm in English Lit and I'm going to analyze a poem or whatever, you know, book that I'm reading to, like, you know, what was this one thinking and what was the author trying to tell us? Well, if the author is God and these are the words of God, every line and every way it's stated, and it's said this way as opposed to that way, and the nuance of the Hebrew word, which has multi layers of meaning, well, if this is God's book, coming from the unlimited God, I'm going to sit there and I'm going to spend as much time really like digging in and then trying to say, okay, what is it saying to me? Because God, the nature of this book is, it's the endless God's communication with us, okay? What that means for us is that it never stops speaking. As another, not this week, but the week before, it says that there's a crazy pasuk. The verse says that God is speaking, and then in the same thing, and then it said, and he spoke to Moses. I don't understand. If he's speaking to Moses, just say he's speaking to Moses. Why does it say he's speaking? And then on the second, in the same sentence, it says, and he spoke to Moses. So the rabbis tell us that God is speaking, it's unlimited. It never ends. What his message is never ending. Now, how do we take it in? Then he spoke to Moses. So Moses, by him taking it in, he's processing it as Moses will process it. Each of us, here's our book. God is speaking to us. How do we each translate it for ourselves? And it's constantly speaking. So let's say this year, today, we're going to study this. in a week from now, take it out again, read it again. What is it saying to me again? Because it's constantly speaking to us, and God is never ending, so his message is never ending. And so in these words, we have to consistently like look back. Every year we are going through a cycle of reading the five books of Moses. And every year we come back to it again because we're in a different place and God is still speaking. And now the message is constant. Now it's like a radio receiver, right? We're going to turn it, we're on 101.1. We're going to go now to 103 and we're hearing different things. It's all out there. It's a question of how are we taking it in? Okay, and one other, again, it's just going back to the parasha, it mentions the manna, right? The man. So the craziest thing, this is the same idea, and we'll finally get to the things that are in front of us. This is all an introduction, okay? It's not easy. It's not easy being an adult, you know, like an actor. This is the idea of the man. It's the wildest thing, but it's the same concept. It says that the man came. The Jewish people look at it. Why they call it the man? Man in Hebrew is like, they said, we don't know what this is, so we're going to call it man based on the fact that we don't understand what we're looking at. Then they start playing with it, they start eating it, they cook it, they're working with it. You know what they call it? Man. Understand. When you didn't understand what it was called, you called it that. Meaning like what? And then now that I know what it is, I'm calling it what? I don't understand. So this is the same idea.
Mana.
Mana. But it's, right? Ma.
Mia mana. Mana shelochet.
Okay, we take it from there and we make that word. But the real original, if you look at the verse, it says they didn't know what it was and they called it that, but they called it man. So what's it saying? When God gives something, God's giving is endless. Okay? Where is a medrash it says? The medrash says that whatever they wanted it to taste like, if they wanted it to be steak, it was steak. If they wanted it to be, cashews, that's what it was. But what is that medrash saying? The medrash is actually saying that it was endless, it could be anything, and it's we who create the limitation. Right? The name is what? And it always stays what? Why? Because the name is saying it can't be defined. It's endless. It's we who create the limitation. And so the nature of this thing is something that's unlimited. Okay? So that's where the struggle that we always are dealing with. It's a struggle, but it's also a good thing, is that we're dealing with an endless God, and we're these limited beings. The thing is, and this is also very interesting, it's true that we're limited, but we also have, and this is again about our legacy, and the Maharal talks about this idea, it's a very powerful idea, is that we are souls. Like what Charlie said the other night, he said, we're not bodies, we're souls, and then that's who we are, and our bodies are what carry us, as opposed to the other way around, that we're physical beings and the soul is like an extra thing. No, we by definition are the soul, okay? That's who we are. Now, as souls, that's already now, we have that much greater, unlimited. Right? We can almost tap into that unlimited aspect. And we, sitting around together here, we're all part of this collective soul, right? That is Yisrael. Like the idea that Jacob has two names, he is Jacob, like we are, like I'm Jonathan and everybody else has their own personal, but we're also part of Yisrael. He took on this mantle of being this greater soul that we're all part of that collective. And that's the soul part of us that has this incredible lack of limitation, let's put it that way. Now just on that point, actually, I can come back another time. We could talk about this. The Maharal on these verses. Now, the Maharal, who is the Maharal? Maharal in Prague lived in the 1500s in, of all places, Prague. Right? So he was, it's interesting, the Lubavitch, Chabad, they'll track their lineage from Maharal to the first, the Balatanya, the first Lubavitch Rebbe, and goes straight through. So they like to, attribute a lot, they like to look at that connection. But his writings are incredible. They were really, they didn't get a lot of attention until about 100 years ago. But they are just incredible. The way he basically is taking Kabbalistic ideas, and his writings are, there's no Kabbalistic mention. Very rarely will he mention the Kabbalah, but all the concepts that he's talking about are Kabbalistic. And so he actually goes through these verses in depth in a sefer called Hurus Hashem, and that's where I want to show you some of the ideas that he brings forth from, again, taking one sentence or two verses, right? And he will like turn them upside down, inside out, all around, and show and bring out from that incredible concepts that are so fundamental to who we are and how we understand ourselves. Okay, so now let's look inside. One other little intro, okay? Everything's an intro here, okay? So the Ramban, Nachmanides, who lived in the 1300s, 1300s. So he wrote an explanation. He wrote a commentary on the Torah. He wrote a lot of other things. Very, very, also very important person in our tradition. He brings a concept, and I think it might be from earlier. He's the one who popularized the idea of something called Ma'asa Avot Simin Labanim. The actions, literally translated, the actions of our fathers is a sign for the children. Okay? So now that can be, we can play with that one also. What does that mean? So let's say, for example, on a most basic level, things that happened to Abraham and Sarah are going to happen to the Jewish people later on. So what happened to them happens to us. It's almost like a foreshadow of things to come. So for example, Abraham and Sarah go down to Egypt because of a famine, and later on, so too his grandchildren end up and great-grandchildren, and then the Jewish people. And so things that occurred to them then, as they're going down, are important. And so you have this like very weird stuff, how Abraham hides Sarah in a box so they don't see her, but then she's taken by Pharaoh, and then nothing happens to her. Well, that's important because the Jewish people have the ability to keep their, you know, there was sexual integrity, that they were, people were, you know, there was none of, that they were protected, that there was, they were not, you know, necessarily, you know, let's say the women of the Jewish people were not taken and forced to, you know, to have relations with the Egyptians, similar to the way Sarah was protected. So, like, what happened to her helps the Jewish people later on. So that's, like, you know, idea foreshadow. The second idea, that what happens to the forefathers happens to the children, can also be taken a different way. That the characteristics, the character traits that they developed would become character traits of the Jewish people, right? So if Abraham is a person who was involved in doing kindness, being hospitable, things like that, so then, so too, the Jewish people will have that type of character trait. So what the character traits that they develop will be important for us in our history. So another similar idea, for example, it says that, it's very strange, Isaac is like very, he's very busy redigging the wells that his father had dug. I was like, what is he doing? Why is he so busy redigging these wells? So the idea perhaps is that he's actually creating a pathway, which is what? He said, look, my father Abraham discovered God. He discovered God, and we can talk about what that means, that he discovered God, but he finds God. So now he develops a relationship with God. Isaac can say, you know, I can rely on my father's relationship. What do I need to make my own? You know, just like I have friends, I have friends, they have kids. Those kids have a connection to me through my relationship with their parents. And so they can rely on that. We can have that connection. But then as it goes down, generation further, the relationship that happens on the tier one, tier two, by tier three already, that relationship or that connection is not strong. What Isaac understood is that he himself had to connect to God direct. He had to make his own relationship. So he goes back to those wells, which symbolize connection to God, and he now digs those wells for himself. He needs to have his own relationship direct with God, which is, again, a character trait, something that is going to be put into the persona, the character of a Jewish person, that we all need to, on our own, go and create that own direct connect with God. Where do we learn it from? From Isaac. Okay, so this concept, we go from foreshadow to actual character traits that become part of our DNA, right? Jewish DNA, we're gomli chasadim, we have this natural thing, we want to help people, be kind, bring people hospitable. Abraham, his open tent, right? That is part of who we are. Seeking God, having a direct connect. That's Isaac. And there are plenty of others. I'm just giving quick examples. Okay, so that's Ma'asev Avosim Labanim. The acts of our fathers will be a sign for the children. So now, let's look at this. Now, finally, let's look at the text, okay? So there are two texts that I have in front of you here, okay? The first one is chapter 12, which is Lech Lecha, right? So, so you have Lech Lecha, which is the famous thing where God comes and asks Abraham to leave his home, right? To go and to look inside here. And then the second one is this is going to be chapter 15, which is the famous, it's called Bris Man of Besarim. It's the idea of the covenant that God makes with Abraham. Nothing to do with the covenant of circumcision. That's another story, okay? But here, so first things first. Let's see what it says right here. Now, it has an English translation here. I'm going to have the Hebrew. If I don't like the English translation, I'm going to tell you. Okay. Now, again, they say they always say that things are lost in translation. The challenge is again, Hebrew is it's not no not Hebrew as like if I go to Israel and we speak Hebrew on the streets, like let's say you know we know people who speak Hebrew, right? There's Hebrew and there's Lashon HaKodesh. They're not the same things. So Lashon HaKodesh means the holy Lashon is the holy language. Which Hebrew is derives itself from? So modern Hebrew, forget about it. It's like a whole new world of you know. It's got a lot going on there. It's a lot of English, a lot of different things that are mixed in. But pure biblical Hebrew is Lashon is holy. It has layers and layers and layers and nuance in the word. So when you translate something over to English, you might actually lose something in the translation. There's an example of here on the bottom of the sheet of in it's verse 6 all the way at the bottom here when it translates over I'm like no way it doesn't work okay so I'm going to go when we get there I was just looking over a couple of like that doesn't work so we're going to try it English something pops out and I said we have to like okay I'm going to tell you where it doesn't work okay so what does it say the Lord said to Abram go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. Okay, so it's interesting. So God says, he says, I want you to lech lecha. I want you to go forth. Now, lech lecha, now let's be more literal. Lech means to walk. Lecha means for yourself, okay? So that's a strange one, okay? There's a whole class we could do on that one, right? What does it mean, I want you to go for you? Okay. So, but that's not what we're going to focus on today. From your land of your birth, from your father's home, to a place that I'm going to show you. Okay, so he doesn't identify to Abraham where he's gone. Okay. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. Now that could be, you'll be a blessing, or you'll be a source of blessing. Okay, there's ambiguity there. Fine. And I will bless those who bless you and curse him that curses you. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you. Okay, so basically the same idea of the source of blessing, right? You get the sense that, you know, it's going to go through him. And he does, and he goes. Abram went forth as the Lord had commanded him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Okay, he takes his wife. And etc. So now what do we see in this promise here? So that God promises Abraham what? Go and I will, in verse 2, I will make you a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you shall be a blessing. Okay? So if God says to Abraham, I'm going to make you a great nation, do you think that means he's going to have kids or not? What is that? What do we think here? Sounds like in that message is, Abraham, you're going to have children, okay?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily? You think that maybe that he'll just like have a legacy or... Interesting. That could be a way of reading it. It's interesting because but you would on the surface, I would think that he's saying to him, you're going to have kids. How am I, you're going to become a great nation?
Well, yeah. Well, that does not mean like people will...
So you'll have just like a lot of people following you.
Right.
And that will make you okay. So
it doesn't mean your own.
Interesting. Okay. All right. That's okay. So you have two sides. One side says Abraham understands this promise that there'll be kids involved. And you're saying, because Rashi points out on this that God was addressing things that happen when you travel. When you travel and you leave a place, so things that you won't have. No one will know who you are. You're I show up to a new place, like, who's that? No one knows who you are. You become anonymous. So God says, you're going to be a great nation. You're going to be famous, okay? Here you're going to travel, right? I'm making you famous. You're worried that when people travel, they can't have, when they're not like rooted, they can't have a family. You're going to have a great family. You're going to have a big family. So I think that's how Rashi, but you're saying, what you're both saying is also, you can spin it the other way as well. So either, well, that's the beauty. We can leave it open and we're all comfortable with that right now. Okay. No problems.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So before he left, did he have all these things? He didn't have children yet, correct?
Did not have children.
Okay. Not have children. But was he known? Because you're saying that, you know, when you leap, when you're somewhere, people know who you are.
Okay, so you want to know, you want some background? I'll give you some background. I'll give you some color.
It doesn't bore anybody.
Not at all, not at all. Not at all, not at all. Okay, you ready? You ready for this? Okay, this is all. Here we go.
Sorry,
class
is going to 12.
Sorry, everybody. It always goes to 12.
Okay.
You forget questions answered.
So it's interesting that, first of all, in the Torah itself, it only tells us something. Everything is very subtle, okay? And then I'll tell you what the Torah says, and then I'll tell you what then our rabbis, the tradition says. And they're really learning it. They're studying. They're taking exactly what we spoke about, the nuance of how things are stated, and then they open it up for us, okay? So the Torah tells us, not about Abraham, but that at the time that Abraham lived, there was a guy named Nimrod. And Nimrod was the guy. He was the world leader. You would say that he created a society that was similar to communism, okay? And that everybody was the same. Everybody spoke the same language, had the same ideas. There was a uniformity of thought. And they were idol worshippers. And now, when we say idol worshippers, that's the question is, you know, how were they primitive? I don't think they were very primitive. I think that it was actually a very sophisticated type of approach, and that the idea of idol worship is to say, if I see everything as kind of broken up into parts, right? So if there's a greater force out there that's unified, then I have to subjugate myself to that greater force. But if that force is broken into parts, and that no part of that force is actually in control of everything, so then there's a god of fire, there's a god of the wind, there's a god of that. So then you break it up, and what does it do? In turn, it empowers the human being to be the all-powerful.
Right? And Nimrod was above all of that?
Nimrod saw himself as the head of...
Of those gods. Yeah.
Right.
He was number one.
Right, he was... Nimrod, from his name, is he was the rebelling against. He and God, it was him and God. We're going to square off. And so now, who was his problem? Who was his nemesis? It was this guy Abraham. He was a real pain in the... Right? And so the Medrash tells us that that he threw him into... He basically said, what happened was, Abraham's father... Abram's father? Terach, thank you. I'm thinking Haran, his brother. So Terach, thank you. So Terach, his father, had an idol. He was an idol merchant, right? And Abraham was breaking his idols all the time. And so he finally takes him to Nimrod and says, my son's a problem. Like, he reported him to the KGB, you know? And they take him, and he says, listen, Abraham, you got to get with the program. You know, you're a problem. You know, we need everybody to be in line here. And Abraham would not give in. And eventually he throws him into this thing of fire, because He said, I want you to bow to this, bow to that, bow. And I guess Nimrod's deal was he was the god. He was into the god of fire, you know. So, well, you can't say that, you know, that you're not afraid of the fire. I'm not. Threw him in. He came out without a scratch. Now, they get all this. What does it actually say in the Torah? It says that Abraham married his niece Sarah. His brother married the other niece, and who were they? They were daughters of the brother who was thrown into the fire as well, who ended up getting killed. Okay? So that actually is stated in. So they get it, they take this off from, the name of the place was Or Kostim, which is the idea of fire, place of fire. And so there's like through the nuance, they're able to pull out all this stuff. But it never overtly tells us that he actually survived the Kivshan Ha'esh, that he survived this furnace. But what's going on in the background before he leaves is that he's a person that is anti-establishment. Nimrod's the establishment, and Abraham is the troublemaker. Okay, but we see that he Rabbi David Foreman had a whole class on these six sentences that come before this one, which talks about how Abraham married his niece, and his brother married the other one, and Lot's the other is the third child that came from his brother. And that Abraham already, we see that he's going out of his way to help his brother's legacy live on. And he sees his marriage to Sarai at the time as being almost like an act of what we call yibum, which is the idea of, you know, what's the English word for it? Levirate marriage, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea of helping continue the legacy of the deceased. Okay, but that's all very, you'd have to, again, you're taking six sentences and very, very, like, you read between the lines, you could see that that's all going on.
Why was the brother thrown into the fire?
So what happened was, the Medrash says that they were all brought there, and Abraham was the first one, and he survived, and the brother, and they're saying to Haran, like, whose team are you on? Are you with him, or are you with, he sees Abraham walk out without a scratch, he's like, I'm with Abraham, and he's like, okay, and then he gets burnt. And the reason they say is because the only way that you actually are given that kind of miracle is when you really buy into the system. But if you're just like, you know, kind of like, I'm with that guy today. It's like, no, that doesn't work. You're like, sorry, buddy. So that was, he was burnt. So that's one of the lessons they learned. Like, either you're in, or don't play with fire, you know. You have to really buy in. Yeah.
How bad was it that he said, Lech Lecha, v'tireh et ha'olam, look what's doing in the world?
So
was the world already developed?
So it seems to be based on the society of Nimrod that there was they were living in the developed world. For him to leave that developed world and to go to this place that God's going to show him was a big deal. It required tremendous faith on his part. That's the first time that we're starting to see an indication, a hint to the fact that Abraham is a person of tremendous belief.
But looking backwards, if you see the backward, if he's standing there 75 years old, okay, so people live till,
longer
in those days. But if he's 75 years old and he's looking backwards and he sees it like this, that's not so great either. So why not choose to leave?
Again, so anything, but look at our own lives. If we know whatever we know, we're used to our lives. For you to leave where you come from, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. So even if it's horrible, you know, there was like, you know, I mean, that's the extreme, okay? Mm-hmm. But we all pretty much have decent lives, you know? Okay, we have this, you know, this aggravation. We all struggle with whatever we struggle with. But to leave that is a big deal, right? Right, so it's not so simple, okay? So, but at this point, what I'm going to learn, I'm going to go with Rashi, even though I think that what you're saying is, I like what you both are saying, this idea that it's not necessarily that God promised him children, okay? But I'm going to understand that he did, okay? Now let's go to the next thing, 15. I'm skipping the other parts, and we're going to go to the next thing. So it says, sometime later, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. Okay, just by the way, remember what I said to you earlier about the idea of God communicating, right? You see that it's all through prophecy that he was probably sleeping. He had some kind of message that came to him. Again, God's not actually you know, articulating, but it's already through translation. He said, "Fear not, Abraham. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." Okay? Now, what's going on here? You asked about background. This is important here. The thing that I didn't put in here, because I care about paper and I don't want to be extra bit. But if you go back to the chapter before, it's the story of Abraham fighting the four kings. The four kings, the leader of the four kings was Nimrod. There were three other kings. The four kings took on the five kings, and the four kings defeated the five kings. And then Abraham came out. Why? Because they took Lot as prisoner, his nephew. And so Abraham leads a force of very small, miraculously defeats the four kings. So now, Abraham, this kind soul, is a warrior now, and he's involved in killing, it's not good. And so right after that, God comes to him and says, "Abraham, don't be afraid. I'm going to shield you. Your reward shall be very great." So now, any time that someone comes and says something to you like this, why is God coming to him? Because clearly Abraham is worried about, he's worried. So God is coming to allay his fears. What is Abraham worried about? So he's worried about the fact that he just got involved in this big, big showdown. He shook up the establishment in a real heavy-duty way. And now he's worried perhaps the whole entire world is going to come out against him. God says, "Abraham, don't worry. I got your back." Okay? Ani magen lach. Anochi magen lach. Schercha harbi mod. Your reward is great. So God says to him, he says, Abraham says, "O Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I shall die childless, and the one in charge of my household is the Mesek Eliezer? Where are my kids? God, where's my, So, and Abraham said further, "Since you have granted me no offspring, my steward will be my heir." Right? So now, the way I understand it, the way it's understood, is that he's saying, "God, you promised me that I'm going to be a great nation. Where are the kids?" So now the question, though, is if this is our father, our he's the one who's the start. He starts everything. He's the great believer. He's willing to go and leave everything because God said go. Well, in that promise, he also told him, "You're going to be a great nation." And he's bothered by the fact that there are no kids. So I think Abraham understood there are going to be kids. So now you have to ask ourselves, I don't understand. If he bought into the system, he's willing to jump into the fire, come out unscathed. He buys in. He goes and fights. He's living really in a different plane of belief. How can he not trust God that he's going to have kids? What's bothering him? If God said you're going to be a great nation, you're going to be a great nation. How is our father Abraham, the great believer, not believing?
No questioning.
Yeah?
You meet Rockefeller.
So what?
He will meet Rockefeller and there will be a good developer. That's the only way, really. He should meet people.
Go out to the world, okay. But here he is. He's got this special relationship with God. God already spoke to him once, told him to go.
The answer is like she's saying, is in the next.
Well, what does it say?
He said, "Look outside and see the stars, and you will be as multiple as the stars."
So God's answering him. Mm-hmm. So God's answering, but here's before you get there.
Sarai was very old at this point. Right?
Okay.
Okay, so I guess now instead of faith.
Well, you know, the question is, by the way, when does this occur? How old is he when he's having this conversation?
Oh, he's older already. He's like 90, no?
No.
No. Okay,
no.
So.
This is after the 75 or before the 75? He was 75 when he was told to leave. So now you've gone back in time?
Maybe.
Okay.
So.
Here we go, the Torah.
Oh, then my...
Torah goes back and forth.
The Torah. Okay, so I'll tell you like this. Just to make you, again. Is that always, how many opinions?
this wasn't an opinion.
One guy, 15 opinions? No, but I'll tell you like this. No, I'll tell you like this. No. So first of all, she's younger. She's 10 years younger than him. Okay, but either way, she's not a spring chicken, right? Fine, but either way, there's a machlokas as to when this happened. Does it happen before or after? I mean, this conversation, even though we see it's right?
It's chapter 12, right?
Yeah.
It could be that this occurs 5 years before Lech Lecha, which is also mind bending. That's one hard to get around.
So he'd be only 70.
Yeah.
And she'd be 60.
And she's 60. But either way.
Sometime later than that.
After the battle.
Oh.
But because it could, again, that already, it's a much bigger discussion because we'd have to like chart out and see how you understand. If you're really going to say that this happened 5 years earlier, and it has to be on the back of that battle that they had there. So did the battle of that occur before he actually was told to leave? Let's just say right now, again, I know, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we have to, but because again, the point is, let's learn it that it's coming after. So it's mm-hmm. not. It's a couple of a year after, 2 years. So he's 77. Okay, let's let it be. Let's not get stuck on that for now. So now, but it seems what I'm bothered by is that it seems that Abraham, the great believer, is questioning God.
Mm-hmm.
God was telling him you're going to have children, and he's saying, God, where are the kids? You told me I'm going to have kids. There are no kids. Right? And so
maybe he had a thought like we had the thought. You mean it's going to be just
But you
the
see that Abraham's
world?
Wild. He goes, this Eliezer guy's going to be my, you know, he's a nice guy, but no, I never saw it as going this way, you know? Okay, so now what does he say? Let's look at the next sentence. He says, the word of the Lord came to him in reply, that you shall not be. That one shall not be your heir, none but your very own issue shall be your heir. So again, you're going to have a kid, right? V'hinei dvar Hashem elav le'mor lo yirashcha zeh. This one's not going to inherit you. Ki em asher yetze mimeacha hu yirashcha. I mean, it's going to be your child is going to be the one that inherits you. And then it doesn't stop there. He says. But yet he took him outside and said, look toward heaven and count the stars. If you are able to count them, right? And he says to him, So shall be your offspring. I don't like it. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't even work in English. Yeah? Okay.
No, it doesn't even work in English.
All right, fine, whatever. But he says, okay, so now the question is, what is going on here? Okay. Again, a couple of sentences in here. What is going on is so wild. The Maharal says to us, it's unbelievable. Okay, so listen to what's going on. So now, first things first. Let's go back to the first thing. He says, God, where are the kids? You told me to leave my homeland. One of the promises would be that I'd be a great nation, which meant I'd have a lot of kids. Where are the kids? So then we say, but Abraham, he's in. I'm going. I'm Lech Lecha. I'm walking. I'm going. So he's clearly a believer. He's jumping into furnaces. He's a believer. So how does all of a sudden the great believer break down and not believe? So the Maharal says, listen.
Hot in the desert.
He says, you know what? Let me explain something. There's two things. You have to understand, there's prophecy, and there's something called a promise. Now, what's the difference between prophecy and a promise? Prophetic visions are said actually in past tense. I'm talking now about something that's going to happen in a month from now. I'm saying as if it happened already. That's prophecy. There's no, is this happening? It's a done deal. Okay? A promise, a haftacha, is totally different. It says, Abraham, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Now, how does that work? It means that this is the beauty of, there's a relationship here. What's saying is, Abraham, I'm going to make you great. But part of that deal is, Abraham, are you going to be great? Are you going to do what needs to be done? Right? That's the haftacha. It works with God and with the one who's receiving Abraham.
Haftacha.
It means a promise. Okay? The haftacha, right? Right? It's a promise, but the promise is predicated on both players, right? The one who makes the promise and the one who's receiving has to live up. What the rabbis will say, we'll see this in other situations as well with Jacob, Shema Yegra Machet, that maybe the sin will break things up, meaning this is supposed to happen, but you need to be part of the deal. If you're not behaving properly, then the promise doesn't happen. It's not a prophetic vision. Prophecy, past tense, it's done. It's happening. That's already, I don't require any, you know, no assembly required, right? But here, saying, no, no, Abraham has to live up to his part of the end of the bargain, okay?
How did he know so that it was a promise? Wasn't a
prophecy, it was a promise?
Yeah, so it was.
But how did he know that? How did he know it was a promise and not a prophecy? Because God supposedly.
So he's saying it's going to happen, but it's not a done. It's not said. First of all, it's not in past tense.
Uh-huh.
But you see that, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is that the same as when the Jonah story that Hashem said, "I'm going to destroy the people of Nineveh," and he didn't do it, but he was going to do it. So
right. So there. So it's not. It's again. It's this is. It gets. When it comes to that story, so again, that is. It's interesting. It needs to, because the Maral also addresses that. He actually brings that case up. How do we understand that? But for, so there is. He leaves it open. It's open ended, and you see that. The fact of the matter is they change their ways.
Yeah.
So there, it, depending on how they react, will be. So that could be that you say it's not a prophecy, but rather more of a promise. So that there is that leeway. Okay, let's just say it that
for
now.
What's an example of one that you're saying they say it in the past?
One of the examples, I think, again, I would need a chumash to show it to you. Again, when it's in past tense. So, for example, I think when they come, when the angels come to tell Abraham that Isaac's going to be born, it says it in the Lashon Hara. That's a prophecy.
In the past.
That's happening. Yeah, it's done. It's a done deal. Okay. In a year from now, we're coming back. He's. It's done. It's happening. So that's a prophecy. That's not a haftacha. So because of it, so he understood. So your question's a great question. Like, how did he know? He understood the way Abraham took the Lech Lecha promise. It's a haftarah. It's a promise. So now he knows that I need to do things properly. So when he goes out to battle, he feels already, and also he had all these things happen where he's getting a lot from God and he doesn't feel maybe that he's doing enough on his end, so that God needs to come back and say to him, Abraham, you didn't do anything. You're still good. Everything's still good.
So that's where our self-choice comes.
But the beauty of it is also, when you see this idea of haftacha, is that God is saying, going back to the Lech Lecha, like you said, the Lech Lecha idea, just to bring that point very much, and it's really, it's a message to not just Abraham, that's to all of us, is Lech Lecha says, I want you to go for you. What does that mean? The only thing that we can give God is ourselves. God has everything except us and what we can be able to become. And that's giving God. Okay? So now, let's get this last point here. So he says, so what's going on? So Abraham, they say, was an incredible astronomer. He understood, he was in tune with the world. Part of how Abraham discovered God is that he looked at the world and he said, it cannot be that this creation is somehow doesn't have a creator that's behind it. But not only that, he saw the uniformity, the unity within the world, and understood that there can only be one unified force, which we call God, behind this.
Not a god of fire, not a god of water, not a
right.
god of...
Right, it's all one. The idea of monotheism, the oneness of God. Like, I just heard this morning, for a second, the radio was on, Religion on the Line, today is the Trinity. The guy says, we believe in one God that has three heads. And I'm going, oh, God. Right? It's like, my mom says, like, okay, Islam believes in one God, but when it comes to Christianity, it's like, when you listen to a Christian try to explain, no, really, there is one God, but it's like, come on, don't give me this three, one, it's either one or, so that we believe in the pure, like, unity. So when Abraham sees, discovers God in looking at the world, it's the point where we say that God looked at the Torah as his blueprint to create the world. Abraham took it so far, he was able to see the Torah in the world. He saw the blueprint because he studied the world, and from that he was able to actually see through it and see the Torah that was the blueprint for it. So that's why they say that Abraham kept the Torah. And again, how far you take this, but again, it does tell us his incredible connection to the world and to the nature of the world. So he looks at the world, and in the stars, he sees he's not supposed to have kids, that his destiny is not to have children. With Sarah, he had no kids. So God says to him in this line, now go back and see what he's saying here in 5. He took him outside and said, look toward heaven and count the stars, if you're able to count them. And he added, so shall be your offspring. But what is he saying there? So the moral says that what God was saying to him, Abraham, I know you think from looking at the stars that you're not supposed to have children. Now I'm taking you outside of that. And then he looked at it and he showed him, he changed it. Now the Maral says something unbelievable here. He takes the Ramban, he takes Nachmanides to task, because Nachmanides says, the next line here is what? Abraham says, and because he put his trust in the Lord, he reckoned it to his merit. It translates better in Hebrew, V'hamin b'Hashem, he believed in God. So when God takes him out and says, come out of your, come outside, go outside of your view of the world, of the astronomy of the world, and understand you're going to have kids, meaning that beforehand it was looking like it wasn't supposed to be, the Maral says that it's all about the belief that Abraham had in God. And that, but what God did here, the most incredible miracle, the miracle of saving him from going into the Kivshan HaEsh, into the fire, into the furnace, no big deal. For his ability to take on the four kings, no big deal. For him to change the nature of the world that said in the astronomy that said that he wasn't supposed to have children, and God actually went up there and changed that. That is the biggest miracle of all. Why? Because in the static realm, to change things is a much bigger deal than in this world. In the physical realm, this is a world, we live in constant change. Things are constantly in flux. We're in spring, it's going to be summer, and then we're going to see things are always moving, there's a constant change. To make changes in those worlds, to make miracles in those types of realms, where there's constantly changing, not a big deal. So says Maral. But to change things in the upper realms, as you go further and further into the heights of the spiritual, it's much more static. It talks about the angels, they're standing. They're omdim, they stand. They're not moving. We, on the other hand, are moving. We're constantly, that's why the idea of Lech Lecha, back to that idea of God says, I want you to walk, right? I want you to move. You're a mover. You're in the world of moving. So now when Abraham sees in the upper realms that he's not supposed to have kids, and God says, I'm taking you outside of that, and also at the same time, I'm changing that, to change that already is like moving, you know, like the idea of moving mountains is even bigger than that. And that was even a bigger miracle, so says the Maral. And that and Abraham saw this, and what's his reaction? V'hamin b'Hashem, and v'yechshevel lo tzedakah. He understood it, he believed it, and he saw the goodness that God was giving him. So, yeah.
What did you mean by you took Ramban to
the Nachmanides, Ramban, he understood the bigger miracles were the physical miracles, and that was a bigger, the beliefs there were a bit greater. Maral says, no, and he kind of like, Nachmanides kind of, Ramban kind of like poo-poos and says, his beliefs were, his emunah was not the big deal. Maral understands that it was all about his emunah, that Abraham's belief and his ability to trust God was so great that that was everything. And he then, the Maral then takes this idea and shows that that's what saved us in Egypt. It's the Jewish people's belief. Now, what was their belief? So he says a number of things. One of the beautiful ideas he says there is that the Jewish people, they're in servitude, they're being oppressed, but they also understood this is not who we are. We're much bigger than this. That the problem with a slave and the slave mentality is that that people start to believe I'm nothing, right? The belief that really saved the Jewish people is they said, we're the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're big people. We don't, you know, so that belief that Abraham had in himself and God and all that was transferred. Again, this is this idea that whatever was created in the belief systems of our forefathers is transferred to us. And that incredible steadfast strength that we have as a people, from there, we have it. We're all of us sitting here today. We have that strength. We have to tap in on it. That's what helped us get out of Egypt. And what propels us always, constantly, to greatness. You know, proportionally, we are, you know, you look at the numbers, the ratios, it just doesn't make sense that as a people, we are able to, that we're still here, that after a Holocaust, you know, you talk to, like, survivors and the ability to rebuild. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. But it comes from this. It comes from an Abraham who has... Again, he's really on his own. It talks about Abraham being on the other side. He's the Ivri. He's on the other side of the plain. He's really like on his own, and he has this connection. He speaks to God, and he's going and doing stuff based on his, you know, these conversations. And, you know, so it's incredible that you see. First of all, again, we're seeing the subtlety in the text that there's like all these different things going on, but that he has this incredible belief that he's able to, okay, God, you're telling me it's going to happen? I'm okay with it. Here's the question. Do we have a couple more minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I want to tell you another idea here, okay? So this is a very, very moral idea. It's so novel. We have to just look at this together, okay? The next thing. So what do we say? We said Abraham's a believer, right? Mm-hmm. What happens? What does he do the next sentence? He's questioning God again. Okay? It's like, come on. All right, it says like this. Next. Look at 7. Then he said to him, I am the Lord. So God says to him, I'm the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans, Kastim, to assign this land to you as a possession. It's interesting that God identifies himself. I'm not the creator of the world. You know who I am? I'm the guy who took you out from, which is also how God identifies himself in the Ten Commandments. He says, I am the one who took you out from Egypt. Again, this is where Nachmanides, I think, and the rabbis, when they talk about this idea of the connection between Abraham and us further down in history, from things like this, the idea that God is identifying himself, I'm not the creator of the world, I'm just the guy who asked you to leave here. But it's interesting, I'm God who took you out from Egypt. You could say again, I'm the creator of this great universe, right? So it's just interesting, like that subtlety, it's so powerful. Okay, now, it says, how am I going to know? God, what is Abraham saying? He says, Lord, oh Lord God, how shall I know that I am to possess it? Well, God's saying, I'm going to give you this, right? And he says, how am I going to know? B'mai dak hir hashana. So there's a lot of question, like, what exactly is that? What is he asking, right? God then answers, okay, Abraham, this is what you need to do. Let's just listen to his answer. He answered, bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old she-goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young bird. He brought him all these, and he cut them in two, placing each half opposite the other, but he did not cut up the bird, et cetera, et cetera. There's a prophetic vision about the idea of the Jews going into exile, being redeemed. Very nice. What's Abraham's question? Here he is, he's asking God again. How am I going to know that Bamaida ki irashana? Bamaida, how will I know ki irashana that I will be inheriting, or they will inherit? Okay, that's his question.
That's the sign.
Okay? And he says, bring me animals, and he cuts them up, and it's like this whole crazy, like, weird deal going on. Okay? So now the rabbis tell us, what's going on here? It's about the karbanos, the sacrifices. Okay? That the sacrifices is the answer. Okay? So God, so again, let's redo the conversation. Abraham says to God, how am I going to know that we're going to inherit this land? God says, it's the sacrifices. Okay?
What sacrifices, Abraham says?
I don't know, he couldn't even ask. Like,
What does that mean?
What's going on? Okay? All right, so now, first of all, what's the question? So there are different... There are actually different approaches as to what the question is, of course, right? Because it can't be just one straightforward, because the truth is there probably are different levels of or planes of things that are going on here. What's Abraham's question? Is he asking, why are we going to get the land? Is he asking, how will we know that they will get to stay in the land? How do I know that they're not going to be destroyed, maybe the question is, how do I know that they're even going to be around, survive, to have a land? Okay, three different things. God says, it's the sacrifices. Okay? Again, how do we take that? How do we understand what it's
saying? Korbanos means different things.
Okay, so now what is a carbon? Mm-hmm. Carbon, okay? Carbon, how do you translate carbon? What's the root? It's
Karov,
to become close, okay? Karov. So Maral says the most beautiful thing. Okay, listen to this idea. Maral says the only way that a carbon, or the concept of a carbon, of bringing a sacrifice that can bring us close, is if we start out at point here. What's this point here? It means that the Jewish people, like we said earlier, have a lofty soul. It's a soul that really... We are our soul, is tahor, it's pure, it's connected. We are really so deeply connected to God in a natural state, but yet before anything starts. So then what happens is, if we sin, that's not who we are. That, he calls it a mikra, it's just happenstance. It's not, again, if I'm such and such, if I'm a, let's create a good analogy here, if I'm let's not do sports. Is he okay with sports? I don't know. Okay. I'm a basketball player. We're in the NBA playoffs now. I'm the greatest shooter of all time. I'm what's his name? Curry, right? I don't miss. I never miss a foul shot. So for me, every night when I go out and I get fouled, I come to the foul line, and it's literally automatic. I have a 92% foul. That's how good I am. It's automatic. If I were to miss five shots, it just never happens. That's just not who it is. So if it happens, it's completely not who I am. Okay? Mahavdil, like we say, like the separate, like the mundane from the holy. Okay? We're saying who we are is a pure soul. So when we do sin, it's just, it's so not who we are. It's so outside of the realm of who we are. So then I can bring a carbon. That's a rectification. How it works, again, that's already mystical stuff. But how that works is only because that's not who we are. So it's really just like, it's a cleansing, but it's not really difficult, because the actual sin never becomes who we are. Okay? And then I just want on a parenthetical, because if someone asked me this idea, but what about a person who's constantly involved in the same sin? But the problem is that they're not in touch with their soul. Mm-hmm. It's not that their soul is any less pure. No, their soul's pure, 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 and completely connected to God in the most intimate way. It's just that there's a disconnect between themselves and their soul. But that's not who they are. The sinning is not who they are. What happens is a person eventually, unfortunately, people start to think that's who they are, and that's where they get lost. But we all have to understand, and this is something we all struggle with. It's a constant thing where we struggle with difficulties, sins, whatever challenges we have, to understand that we have to elevate and see ourselves on a much higher plane. So the morale is saying to us, we're on that much higher plane. We're much higher. That's who we are. Mm-hmm. Therefore, so that's what God is saying. Right? He's saying to him, Karbanos. What's the answer? How do I know that the Jewish people are going to survive and be around forever? It's about Karbanos. What do we mean, Karbanos? The only reason that they have Karbanos is because this is who they're loft. This is who they are. It's... They're on such a lofty plane. This is who they are. So you want to know about the survival of the Jewish people? However we understand this question, it's a short-term survival, being connected to the land, that's a whole other beautiful idea that he has there. Let's just keep it on this level. How do we know that the Jewish people are going to survive forever? It's because of Karbanos. The whole idea that they can have it is because that's who they are. It's the nature of the people that were so lofty, where souls are so... a pristine and above and connected, so that a carbon exists. It's a creation only based on the fact of the loftiness of the Jewish people. So that's what. So now that, again, back to Abraham. So Abraham is saying to God, how do I know that they're going to inherit Abraham? Your kids get a karbanos. If they can get a karban, it's because of who they are. Yeah? And so that's, so therefore, so in this conversation, so Abraham's questioning of God. So some say, how could he ask this question at this point? But he wants to, it's more a concern about the long term, about his children. Now that he's going to have children, how do I know that they're going to inherit? No, Abraham, your kids are going to inherit who you are. That same soul is going to be passed down. And we sitting here, this is our legacy.
That's an important,
right? Okay?
That's an important line.
Correct.
Your kids are a part of your soul.
Correct. And so that's where it goes from Abraham, it goes to Isaac and Jacob, that the three together, and that's where we're coming from. It's solidified through that three. They call the chain that has the three together becomes unbreakable, and so. But that is the soul that we all have, and so when you look at these lines. Right, from God's Torah, right? Each line, it's something that's worth to learn the Hebrew just to be able to get the nuance, mm-hmm. but to be able to come back and see it and hear the messages that Abraham got from God and the conversation and the belief that was created there, and then for us to then figure out, to like take it in, process, think about who God is, what God is, how we then interact and relate. But we should know, the takeaway is that we have this incredible legacy. We have this incredible, like I once, it's interesting, I remember I went to, I had a cousin that was going to intermarry. And so I went to my rabbi, Mayor Tursky, and I said, what do I tell him? He says, you have to tell him, you have a treasure. It's the Torah, it's this legacy. You're going to give it up without even looking at it. He had not, you know, he was very secular. Like, go study, understand where you're coming from, understand this incredible treasure that we have before you're going to go and take that next step to walk away from it. And so this is what we're, our blessing. Our blessing is that we have Abraham, so that when you open up and you pray, what's the first blessing in the Shemoneh Esrei? We talk about Abraham, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Magen Avraham, right? It's all, we connect to these people. This is our roots, and these are the people that how we connect to God is through these people. And so, the more we understand about them, the greater a connection that we can attain.
I have two questions.
Sure.
That was great. Since we don't have korbanos today,
mm-hmm.
the sacrifices.
Yes.
Does our tshuva
so two things?
Does that become
one thing? One thing it says the tshuva for sure, and then it also talks about learning about the korbanos.
Right.
Which is in the Torah. It's also, again, this is a very novel thing. But again, learning the Torah and studying the Torah, we connect on a very deep way, again, to this. We're somehow connecting to God through His Torah, through His communication, right? So when we learn about the Karbanos, that somehow also is a big rectification. How that works, I don't know.
Can I say this?
Yeah.
Don't they say also that today prayer is instead of Korbanos,
right. Correct.
And that's how we
right.
get close. Is
so the
moral,
so it's interesting. So the moral actually says in this piece, he talks about just studying the karban,
right?
Which is interesting because someone said that same idea. What you said about the idea that we say that prayer comes to as a replacement for the loss of sacrifices. So then it would be the same idea for sure. That would take both.
So my question is: okay, we are our holy soul. We make mistakes. We then have the choices wow, Hashem, I realize I've done something that's not Torah-dick,
right.
You know, or whatever it is. I've made a mistake, conscious, unconscious, whatever it is. Is that free choice? And where is the free choice here for Abraham when it wasn't told him? You're going to do this and this and this, and I say so.
Yeah, so he could have said,
Abraham crying to him like, so when am I going to have children? Like, is that?
No, but he could have said, I'm not in. I don't want to go. Uh-huh. Can you imagine what would happen? I mean, the whole history would change, right? There's a lot to discuss about free will, like in terms of there are different, you know, approaches to free will. But one of the things that in this piece is again, I can't say this on my own, but one of the things the Maral talks about in the line of belief is that, and it's interesting about free will, is that Moses was told to speak to the rock, and he hit the rock. He was supposed, first time around, the Jewish people didn't have water. Moses goes to God and says, what do I do? Hit the rock, Moses. Hits the rock. You think spring water is the, you think, you know, it's in the Bible already. Right? No. So, you know, so the second time around, he says, I want you to speak, and he hits it. And he doesn't go into Israel because of that. And it says it in the Torah. It says, because you did not believe in me to sanctify my name, this is why you're not going in.
That you took it upon yourself.
So now what's interesting is, Moses is Moses. We're talking, this is like, we talked about how lofty Moses. How does, so how, what, but one of the things that happened at Mount Sinai, the way the Torah was given over, it was forced on the Jewish people. Right? Now what that means is, that the revelation was so powerful that they had no choice. It was like a no-brainer. Later on, it was supposed to become much softer, to the point where it would be almost like, instead of hitting the rock, it would be, here, I'm going to ask you, and now you decide. Free will. You choose. Which, 1,000 years later, it happens at the Purim story, that the Jewish people accepted the Torah more willingly. So, but that, again, this idea between free will, about accepting as opposed to being forced into something. So, you know, if that, you know, giving us more space to be able to, you know, choose and become. That's really where we live today. Mm-hmm. We live in God's given us a lot of space.
Boy, do we have a lot.
Yeah, a lot of space.
What I want to say is, in my opinion, which is very fitful to me personally, the Jews don't like each other. We are just, one is here and one is there, and one, this one goes here and this one, I cannot go into that shul. Why? Because whatever. Is that good?
No, it's not a good,
good
thing.
Approach.
No, it's not a good thing.
I could go wherever I want to go.
Right.
If I'm a good person, I could go to wherever.
Are you saying
But what, don't but... tell me that you are better than I or vice versa. And okay, that's a very big problem. And to live in Israel, that some of them, I don't even know their correct name, that they could say that they would throw stones on an Israeli soldier, that he is protecting him, and to say that his neighbor, the Arab, is whatever. Where is the justice?
Right. So, true.
That's a whole different lesson, right?
All these lessons are there, at least a year of studying.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. As to 100%, there's something off. There's something.
Even in
all strains of society, you go from the ultra-Orthodox and to the most, there's going to be good and bad in all.
Obviously.
So what you just described is something that there's something really fundamentally off with someone that could do that. It's not even a question. What's the question? There's no question. Just to take this also, in the prophetic, like, when you go into other realms that we call like spiritual, that's not all good. It could be bad and it could be good in all those realms, in all these things. So that's the nature of the world. The way God created it is that there's going to be good and bad in every realm, in every level. In ultra-Orthodox, there are bad people, there are good people. In the conservative form, there are good and bad. And
the Bible started the good and bad.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's a constant, and there's no exception to this rule. That I would say.
Can I just ask what happened to your? Did you approach your cousin after you spoke to Rabbi
Let's go to that. Here's where that happened.
Not so simple.
His fiance ended up converting.
There you go. Well, that's
right. But it's never simple.
Never simple.
It's complicated, as they say.
I'm sorry. I'm from a shtetl that Rabbi Tversky lived in my shtetl.
Okay.
So it's
old
history.
There you go.
Wow.
And one of the Tverskys were in the same camp that I was.
Oh, really?
Which is in the Ukraine.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a big, big family.
Yeah.
Landless, love you.
I got introduced to these new people in my life, some different, through JWRP, which is the Jewish Women's Renaissance Project, and they take us to Israel. I am not observant as others.
You're the way you are. You are who
but,
you are.
No, but what I want to say is, if we start small, maybe it'll spread. And I see, I just want to say a comment to, you know, you, well, both of you. Don't start crying, Debbie, please. I see it coming. And even with Avi, I know he's in and out, is that I've found the Orthodox community very open and welcoming to us and not judging of us at all. And I feel very welcomed by that, maybe at different levels, but I would have never seen myself, like I would have looked at you and gone on, no, different
see, because
but you know
why?
But I don't mean
but
it that way,
why?
But I'm saying if it starts, it's like starts small and then maybe someday it will spread larger and larger.
Sure.
A lot of
it's
us
it's
come
true.
From where you are, or where
no, but that,
you
but
know?
No, but the answer is that it's 100% that if you do things, it's always the rabbi who went and said, I'm going to change the world, realize he couldn't change the world and like ends up maybe he can change himself.
Right.
But the idea of like starting on the smallest level, if you could change the four, you know, this area, just 4 or 5 people, 10 people, 100 people, it you know, it's a little light lights up the darkness type
yeah.
of thing. It has
and
a
even,
major
even
impact.
If it's just a perception and not the reality or the whatever, but I just feel
well, I have something to add to that. When I was in Israel, Lori got up in front of the stage. You know, there was like half Orthodox, well, maybe not half, but like,
right.
you know, a lot of secular and a lot of Orthodox. And she goes, how many of you secular women out there feel like you're being judged by the Orthodox people? And like the whole room raised her hand.
Really?
She goes, and how many of you Orthodox women out there feel like you're being judged
hands.
By the secular people? And they all raised their hand. And it was like really eye-opening, like, oh my God, we're judging each other. We don't even know each other. We're
right.
judging
so
each
I want to take it to another level, because every February for the last 7 years, I go on my own sort of mission. It's a learning mission called the Chizuk Mission.
7 years already?
With observant women. So it's all observant women. So this past year, it was a group of 45 women, and there was a segment of them that were educators from Borough Park. That were Hasidic ladies, like with the shtetl and with the hat on top of the shtetl. You know, they wear aprons on Shabbos, like the whole thing. A world of women that, as an Orthodox person, I just would never associate with them otherwise. So them to me are sort of like, oh, they're like on a whole other level.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a whole article a couple of weeks ago in Bina Magazine, which is one of these magazines, just about this Chizuk mission. How even within the Orthodox world, there's you know, such different variations. And I'll just say that one of the women who was a Balash Tshuva, you know, she's like me, we didn't grow up religious, she gave a class on our Chizuk mission. And after the class, I noticed one of the ladies, who was one of these little starky ladies from Bar Park, is waiting online to talk to her. She wanted to talk to her. There's like a line of people wishing her Mazel Tov, so great. So I'm standing behind her and I see that she has tears streaming down her face. So I take her by the shoulders and I said, "Hi, Arechi, where are the tears coming from? I'm just curious, like, what is this about?" And she said, and it was so shocking to me, she said, "I want what she has. She's a Balash Tshuva, and she's so connected, and she so believes, and I want what she has." And I'm thinking to myself, really? Like, I know you had a direct line, like you people, like all you Borough Park ladies have, like a direct line to God himself, you know? And it was just an eye-opener to me to realize, like, we all judge each other and we don't. And if we can just start slowly connecting to each other, you know, whether it's observant, not observant, and even within the observant world, how we're all so different in our approaches, if we can also connect and stop judging each other and realize, like, we all want the same thing, you know? We all want the same thing. And we all have the same neshama. And we got to stop just judging each other and connecting slowly. So whether it's JWRP, whether it's within the Chizuk mission, so if we can all just slowly just start connecting with each other, I think it does start with us. It doesn't have to be, I'm going to change the world. It's like, okay.
Can I recommend it's called Incredible. The book is called Incredible. It's an incredible read. It's the life and story of Rabbi Wallace, who runs Arachim in Israel, which is an organization that gets people who are in the secular world.
That's for Israelis, right? It's
like, right. Well, I think he happens to be in Israel, but he's right. from New York. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's from New York. And it's just an amazing book because he goes eventually in his story, he starts it with it, but he then goes for the rest of his life. He starts the book with how he found his, one of the great-great-great-great-grandfathers of his that was the last of the three Jews, who the other two were cousins of his, that were killed by the Spanish in the Murano time. And he says, you know, he went to Spain in the end and said, we want you to honor these people, and they didn't. But that's just the part of it. The rest is how he took and takes people in. He even had a parrot who would just repeat everything he said and wound up saying something of a halachic version to someone who said, that's from a parrot, what are you talking about? He said, well, come study with us. Because he was not Orthodox when he grew up. He found an Arachim meeting at some point in his life and went and learned and then became more involved. So it's so connected to what we're doing at, you know, JWRP and all over the world.
I just want to share one other very quick story, which is
incredible, is the name of the book.
Also, just an example of how we judge each other is I have a friend, Wendy, who lives down the block, who she was a singer. She and her four sisters were all singers. Like, there are pictures of them, you know, like professional pictures as young people. At 18, she was singing at the Playboy Club. Her father was sitting in the back, but she's a very amazing singer. So one, she became from through Asian LA. She sang in Vegas and LA for 25 years. But her sister also became from through Asia, but really became very stark and moved to Passaic and, you know, was very, very, very stark. So I remember one Shabbos I met, her sister was visiting from Passaic, so I went to visit, and she's with her little snood and her, like, sneakers and, you know, kind of a fluffy, frumpy kind of skirt, and she's like, oh, hi, nice to meet you. I'm like, oh, nice to meet you. I'm thinking to myself, oh, she's really broke. She's really broke. So fine. That a few weeks later, they were having a show in Passaic. It was a woman show, a one-woman show just for women. And this sister of hers, which I didn't realize, had initially, she'd been married to a non-Jew in her former life. They got divorced. And then she had 20 years of dating, like, nightmares, like shidduch dating, when she became very frumman. So she did a one-woman show based on all these dating scenarios, like these crazy dating scenarios. So we go to this show, and this frumpy woman, I'm like, oh, nice to meet you, and her little snoot like this, I'm so nice. And I'm like, wow, she's real, like, I see her in this one-woman show. She's like, whoa! And like, just like, and I was like, oh my God, the power of this woman. And I think, and it just helped me realize yet again that you meet people and you don't realize the power behind each person. Like, we just have to get to know each other. Because if I just look, and I was guilty of it. I was like, oh, she's nice for me, little lady, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
And it was just, it was a real lesson for all of us.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
You remember Shoshi Abner, may she rest in peace?
Yeah.
Okay. There was a movie, I remember watching it when I was a kid. Her father was the writer or director of this movie. She was in it. She was the star. It was a Danny Kaye movie. He was a musician, and she had some kind of accident and was, her legs were injured, and she couldn't walk and couldn't anything. But Danny and his wife got her back to walking. That was Shoshi Avner.
Right.
100 years before, she was the woman who lived in our neighborhood as an Orthodox woman, you know. And I read the clip once. I saw that her, you know, her maiden name. It was like, and someone said, yeah. You know, she does.
Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So can I take you home?
I'm trying to figure out if that
I'm happy to take you.